From the Sky News Centre at 5, Scotland Yard detectives reviewing Madeleine McCann's disappearance have identified a number of potential suspects. Our reporter Mark White has more.
Since opening their review of the Madeleine McCann case, Scotland Yard detectives have ploughed through thousands of Portuguese police case files. They've now identified a number of potential suspects, people they'd like to speak to in connection with Madeleine's disappearance, if only to eliminate them from the investigation. Detectives are now embarking on a new phase of tracing and interviewing those individuals.
Police say they've found a bomb during a follow-up search after a failed ambush targeting officers near Belfast. 6 shots were fired at them as they got out of their vehicle yesterday, but no one was injured. A chief constable investigating the use of dead children's identities by undercover police officers says it was common practice. Mick Creedon's looking into claims a special squad in the Metropolitan Force used the names in the 80s. The man who denies murdering 5-year-old April Jones told officers he never thought of calling 999 after he claimed he accidentally ran her over. Mark Bridger has broken down in tears while hearing his police statements read out in court. £200 million a year could be saved if fire and rescue services became more efficient. A report from the Chief Inspector of Fire Services, Sir Ken Knight, says some stations are doing much more than others on similar resources. Plus, he says they're not as busy as they used to be.
Fire deaths down, fires down, fire injuries down, and no small part to the role of the fire and rescue service and firefighters that have driven those down. So a 40% reduction in call-outs over the last 10 years means that we can now look again at how this service is delivered.
And more than £500,000 worth of jewellery has been stolen at the Cannes Film Festival. Thieves are said to have broken into a hotel and made off with the haul, which was due to be worn by stars on the red carpet. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
BCFM.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. They want you to forget, but we want you to remember. So, helping us review this week's news is Ashley Ward candidate for the recent local elections, Dave Dobbs, who is standing for the birthday party, was also a candidate for Bristol Mayor. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wants to attack Syria and Iran. So he visits Moscow. But as new Russian fleet sails into the Mediterranean, he gets a cool response from President Vladimir Putin. And 3 weeks to go until the not-so-secret as they used to be, NATO Mafia Bilderberg Club. They have their annual Slime Fest. This year they bless us with holding it on British soil. The protest festival outside is already being organised. They don't appear on the university curriculum, but they control most of the money in the Western world. Yes, the Bilderberg Club, founded by a Nazi SS officer. But what's the latest on their links to fascism, war and organised crime? And doing something about First Bus's virtual stranglehold on our need to get to and from work every day. To many, it feels like a racket. So, can suburban railways and bus rapid transit do the trick? Judy Boston joins us, who's been one of the prime movers in public transport in Bristol, helping us to get more frequent services on the Severn Beach Line. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. I ought to start by apologising for last week's forecast, where we said it was going to be sunny with no rain last Sunday, which, of course, it wasn't. It was a little bit rainy, but let's see if the Weather Outlook can do a little bit better this week. Tonight, lows of 7 degrees Celsius and some light rain. Highs this weekend of around 13, generally cloudy, with some sunny spells, showers on Sunday. Highs next week, around 20 degrees Celsius, a fairly sunny and warm week. Next weekend's the 25th and 26th of May, highs of 16, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com, and you might have noticed it was a little bit vaguer than last week's. Anyway, helping us review this week's news is Ashley Ward candidate in the recent local elections, Dave Dobbs, who is also standing for Mayor of Bristol for the birthday party. Hi, Dave, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hey, hello Tony, how are you doing?
Nice to see you. Now, first of all, the birthday party, what is it?
It's a political party. It's a genuine, registered with the House of Commons political party, which costs £150 to register, takes only two people to make a to register a political party. You've got to share a few posts if you want to sort of keep it down to two people. I mean, that's how many we've got in the officially in the birthday party.
Okay, so it's you and who?
Me and my good friend John Balash, who's the treasurer. I've got to say, we've never actually had one single donation. I don't think we've even had a pound. Not that we've really tried to put out.
Have you been chatting to big businesses, KPMG, people like that, saying, look, you know, we can do what it takes for you as a political party?
As of the moment, I've got to be honest with you, I haven't. We've never knocked on any doors. I don't really believe in any other sort of door knocking. You know, what it's really about is just getting involved, really. And not to, you know, if you're not in it to win it, but you're in it for the fact that you've got something to say and that you can stand on the same podiums as all of those politicians can say, and when they say what they're going to say and you know it's absolute lies, you can actually put your money where your mouth is.
Okay, so the idea is that you're there to counter some of the lies you think that the mainstream party politicians are coming out with. What sort of things?
Well, just what sort of things? It's just, well, I mean, it's just the whole thing is, you know, the whole kind of every stage of what I hear come out of most politicians' mouth is just absolute, you know, from start to finish. I just couldn't really sort of like, but I mean,
okay. What about, you know, say for example, the management of the economy? Would you have something to say about that?
Masses to say about that.
Go on then.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, I've written a book called Laughing Gas, and one of the reasons I was doing this is to try and promote the book, and the book's very much about the structure of the financial sort of like the financial world and how the banks have been completely and utterly just I mean the banks are like private people that are just basically taking all this money. They've got this kind of claim and this right to sort of like to take the money from the government and basically not lend it out, and it seems that the politicians are in collusion with the banks, and the banks seem to be in collusion with sort of like with anyone who wants to start up a war, and very little money seems to be coming from the banks and being lent to the people where it's really needed to sort of like do the things that they want to do and to make this world, to make this country at least, and to the world at large run properly. And it's and we're all seeing the same thing. I've never seen so many people that have studied, you know, ever since Zeitgeist came out and we started understanding terms like fractional reserve banking.
This is an internet film, wasn't it? Yeah,
it was an amazing film actually. Zeitgeist is, and the probably what's trumped Zeitgeist as of lately is Thrive, which is also an amazing video, which is follows in a very similar sort of foot as Zeitgeist, which really sort of takes you through the sort of like the flaws of fractional reserve banking.
I mean, for a lot of people, I think they'll say, you know, a lot of this stuff to do with the economy is we'd really rather someone else dealt with it. And a lot of it seems like jargonistic, very difficult to actually get to the bottom of. But you've just talked about fractional reserve banking. That's one very fundamental thing to understand about the way banks operate. What is it?
Well, it's understanding that a long time ago, in by the end of the 60s, we were sort of like there was so much debt in the US dollar was in so much debt that France was asking for all its money back in gold, and that's when a new situation, because of all the debt, there needed to be some kind of resolution where everyone gets paid back, or they just make the hole a lot bigger. And the option that the American government went for, along with the British government, we only remember it probably as decimalization when we had a big change in our economy in the early 70s. But what we saw was that basically, instead of having all the value of the US dollars tagged to a volume of gold, suddenly the value of the US dollar was tagged to the movement of cash. Not anyone, not like the banker's cash or the government's cash, but the movement of all cash. So it's once you've got the movement of the whole global financial system going through the US dollar, and then it's being timesed by 10, if not more, it's just free money. The bankers are getting free money. And when you've got free money in a situation like this, and they're printing off money at such stupid volumes, and it's not actually going to the people, then you've just got a complete robbery of wealth. It's just a complete vacuum, a black hole of just of.
But getting back to this term, fractional reserve, Dave, what I understand it to mean anyway, maybe Martin can educate me if I get it all wrong, is that actually the banks only keep a very, very tiny amount of the money that they've actually lent out in deposits themselves. So what we're saying is that they're basically making money up out of nowhere and lending it out at interest. And it's
you know, because of that, if everybody came to get their money from the bank at the same time, there's no way they could all do it, because this money is actually fictional money that's being made up. I mean, we like to think of money as there being a finite quantity of it, but basically the banks have a license to make this stuff up out of thin air and then lend it out at interest, and that money's lent into the economy as debt. So that's what they, when they say fractional reserve, that there's only a fraction of the money that is actually out there the banks actually really ever held in the first place. So most of the money that's out there is this kind of fictional stuff that's been created by a magic wand. Someone's made a magic wand, pressed a key on a computer, and suddenly it's appeared in a bank account.
Well, yeah, I totally agree with everything you say there. The only thing I would say to add to that is that it's kind of, most people will accept that as a viable system all the time the banks are lending money to them. But once the actual money, once they've actually start, you know, quantitative easing is when we actually start lending money over and above the quantitative easing bracket, when there's not enough movement to generate the type of money the governments want to spend, so they start printing off more than the official sort of like quotas that they can run with fractional reserve banking. So that really means that they start stealing the money out of people's bank accounts. They start printing off more than is ever feasible. They just start pumping money out, and it starts devaluing and devaluing and devaluing all the currency around, and it starts pushing prices up. Inflation goes crazy. We're all just getting robbed on every level, and it's our consent in this that's got to be looked at and understood. And the only real way we're going to get around this is all of us really starting to understand on a very finite level how this works.
Well, I like your exposition of all this, Dave. Martin, can you just explain? It seems that Dave's saying here, and I would probably agree with him, that the banks are setting the rules of the game. The politicians are supposed to be, but they're not setting the rules of the game anymore. The banks are, and the politicians have been bought by these bankers.
Yeah, I think you've got to distinguish between fractional reserve banking, which has been around as long as banks have been around, although in fact the fractional focus of this is, I mean, that banks are leveraged much higher than they used to be. In the era before 1971, they had to keep a proportion of their assets back.
Okay, when you say leveraged, what you mean is this is the proportion that they're actually lending out that they don't have compared to what they actually do have.
You've now, but what happened in 1971 was that the dollar was linked to gold in the Bretton Woods system, and because they couldn't afford to fight the Vietnam War, they decided, well, we'll get rid of that, and we'll just start printing money. And so you've then got fiat, what they call fiat currencies then. There's nothing backing it. There's no gold backing.
I mean, it's almost, I mean, isn't it like counterfeiting? Yeah. Isn't it like them having a couple of plates to make pound notes? And
well,
just
I think this is, people are beginning to be aware of how important all of this is, but I think it is important to try and be as precise as possible when we're unpicking it. What they do is they say, oh well, you don't really understand all of this. You're confusing one thing with another. People know, if they've got any sense at all, they can smell a rat now. It's quite obvious that the people running the financial sector either A, didn't know what they're doing, or do know what they're doing and they shouldn't be doing it. And I think that what we need to do, it's not just a fringe thing. I mean, there's an organisation called Positive Money, which you may have come across, which is campaigning against fractional reserve banking, and they're trying to lobby all the decision makers and say, well, why doesn't the government just provide the money that it's required to run the economy? Why contract that to the private sector banks, who are in any case bankrupt?
Yeah, well, why don't they?
Well, because basically the private sector banks have got too much political power. And but when they were bailed out in 2008, they were rescued from themselves, and instead of changing their behaviour, they said, oh goody, we can now carry on much as we did before. In fact, the derivatives market is now bigger as a bubble than it was then. And of course, but all that means really in the end is it's going to crash, because of course all this funny money eventually is just funny money, and when it crashes, people suddenly realise that it's not really there.
Thanks, Martin, for explaining that. Now let's have a look at the political parties. Dave, what's your thoughts on the main parties, the Conservatives, Lib Dem and Labour?
I think they're going down. I think people, it's just I think they're gonna, you know, they're so last century, and I just think we've got to accept that, you know, they've got their place, but you know, we've seen what happened at sort of like when Tony Blair sort of like turned the whole kind of, he created new Labour when he turned the whole Labour Party upside down, and suddenly instead of having sort of like everyone on the top disseminating the information down to the leader, and the leader represents the masses, when he turned it upside down and he made the sort of like the top henchmen sort of like in control, and everyone had to sort of like jump when they were told to jump, it was the end of what Labour was. you know, that's not to say that, because I speak to many people that are members of the Labour Party, actually, and they still stand for the good old-fashioned sort of like rules and what Labour was about, which was, you know, fair rights, and sort of like it was the fact that it was everyone, and everyone was in there, everyone had a voice, and that doesn't exist in the Labour Party anymore, as was demonstrated after the when the Labour councillors tried to join George Ferguson's cabinet.
Martin.
Well, I think that's a fair comment. I mean, you've got to remember why the Labour Party went for that kind of top-down structure. If you think back to the 70s and earlier, there's always been a left wing and a right wing in the Labour Party, like two twins. And there was a lot of rowing and arguing, and of course the rowing and arguing that the conservative media, and the media is generally conservative, would pick up on that and say, well, look, they're rowing and arguing, they can't agree amongst themselves, don't vote for them. And so there was a kind of pressure even from the left of the party, which I'd include myself, that we've got to look more professional if we're going to win, you know, that we've got to try and beat these people at their own game. So that was the idea behind it. But of course what happened with Tony Blair when he took us to war with Iraq is he caused a great deal of anger at the grassroots of the Labour Party, because that's our reputation as a party that's against war and against imperialism being shredded.
Well, I just want to bring
very upset about
just want to bring you guys up to date, because we've just had an announcement today that George Ferguson has announced his new cabinet, and Labour councillors Mark Bradshaw and Brenda Massey have joined the Mayor's Rainbow Cabinet, as they call it, and taking on two of the toughest briefs in the city. That's Chris Brown writing on Bristol247.com. Mm. So, you know, we've had this debacle since the mayoral elections, but now Labour are in there, Martin.
Well, I mean, that's the first I've heard of it. I mean, as I said on this programme last week, it's up to those who are making the decision to decide whether to go into the cabinet or not. The fact of the matter is that central government cuts are coming to Bristol, whoever's in the cabinet, whoever's the mayor, and whether we had a mayor or not. The policy has already been decided at central government level, and really we're just talking about what people are going to administer the cuts at local level. And even if Labour had won the mayoral election, we would have still been in the same position of having everything cut by central government. Ultimately, we've got to change the central government in Britain to something that's actually concerned about the people. But then, of course, you're going to run up against things like the Pentagon and Wall Street, and these people don't play fair.
Just to go through the run-up of the cabinet that's been announced today, Councillor Mark Bradshaw, Labour, is doing transport planning, strategic housing and regeneration. One of the city slackers, who doesn't like coming on this programme, obviously because he's got more important things to do, that's Councillor Simon Cook. He's a Lib Dem, who won by, I think it was just 14 votes the local election earlier this month. He's doing leisure, tourism, licensing and community safety. Councillor Jeff Gollop, Conservative, is doing finance and corporate services. And Gus Hoyt, the Green Party councillor, he's doing neighbourhoods, environment and council housing. Councillor Barbara Jank, the Lib Dems, health and social care, and Brenda Massey for Labour is doing children, young people and education. Dave, the Labour are in the cabinet here in the city now. Do you think that's a good thing?
I mean,
doesn't it matter?
I think what's quite fascinating is, I mean, I wasn't too sure about George, but I'm a great believer that sort of like the proof comes in the pudding. You know, we'll see. I think he's a really nice bloke, actually, and I think having someone who's got Bristol at heart rather than sort of like another agenda or another political party, he seems to have Bristol at heart. And I think that is, if he's reffing, sort of as it were, refereeing between all of these different sort of like candidates, and all the, you know, I think we might end up with sort of like some quite interesting decisions rather than. You know, I think he's a nice bloke, and I think ultimately it's who's the actual ref in this, and George Ferguson is playing more of a referee, I think.
Martin, it seems that you're
dating
numbers.
I don't think he's going to be a referee. I'm afraid he's basically a king with an advisory council.
Well,
and that was the argument against Labour going in, because there's no actual decision-making power. Well, he will decide.
We were saying last week with Peter Abraham, weren't we? A dictatorship, basically. That's what people voted for when they voted for a mayor.
In the rest of the country, people will find it very strange that we've now got an independent mayor who's got all the political parties in his cabinet, and that's Bristol for you. We're a bit strange, aren't we? We're a bit odd. And I think George Ferguson tapped into that kind of sense in Bristol that we want to do things differently here. But I'm afraid the problem is that the national and international financial situation is dire. drastically dire. And if we're not in a position of deciding how to spend more on nice things, we're going to be deciding who gets cut. And of course, by all that happens there is we're all going to have to put our hands on the knife and take responsibility for cutting whatever it is going to be cut.
Now,
and then we'll all get covered
this whole
blood.
Business about how decisions are made in the cabinet now, with Labour in there, because Labour were insisting that they wanted voting rights. Let's just have a look at how it's been how it's been sorted out. Labour's demand for voting rights, says Chris Brown on Bristol247.com, in cabinet over Mayor's decisions has been agreed.
Oh.
But the Mayor will still have overall decision-making powers, meaning he can override the wishes of a majority in cabinet any time he likes. So really, there's
it's
you
a
can
constitutional
vote.
Constitutional monarchy.
Is that what it is? Constitutional
monarchy. When I was running, I was actually born. I was born in Lewes, and I was actually born on what was the battlefield.
Lewes. Well, this is in Sussex.
Yeah, that's just outside of Brighton in Sussex, and it's where we actually in 1264 there were two kings, King of England, Henry the.
I think you're thinking of the revolt of the barons, aren't you, Simon de Montfort?
Simon de Montfort, absolutely.
He was
right,
not
yeah.
a king.
No.
He was a parliamentarian, wasn't he?
He was a parliamentarian, but he came and it was Henry the Third. He was down at Lewes Castle, and Lewes Castle was the first Norman armoury built after William conquered Harold, and. In 1264, after Henry III decided he was going to rip apart the Magna Carta and thought it was a load of old rubbish, and he actually believed that no one actually at that time really understood, or perhaps they did, but no one really understood at that time that the common law was actually a rule book for the kings. It was to stop the kings doing so much reckless killing. It was to try and keep them in line. And when they ripped it up, it was the King of England and his brother, the King of Germany. They were walled up in the sort of like in the safe haven of Lewes Castle. And Simon de Montfort came down with half of London and took them both alive. And rather than killing them, he held them at knife point and got all the gold off the King of Germany, Henry III's brother, and off Henry III, he got, who was quite broke at the time, he got basically the country. He divided the country up into all what we now understand as the local our local elections wars our boroughs, and that's how we originally sort of like fought for our local elections, fought to decentralize.
But it's all becoming much more re-centralised now, isn't it?
It's a tragic shame because it's really.
And in fact, not even just re-centralised to Westminster, re-centralised to Brussels.
To Washington, mate. Wall Street.
Yeah.
That's where the real decisions are made.
Okay, well, we've had a little chat about the political parties. Martin, you know, Dave here is really trying to challenge the system, this political party system, which you yourself have said is virtually controlled and owned by the city. So isn't he doing the right thing by trying to break up these break the mould, as in a way the city has done by voting for George?
Well, I mean, he's exercising his democratic rights as a citizen, and people need to know what they are, and they also need to know the history of where they came from, and therefore they'd value them more if they knew that history. I'm a member of the Labour Party more in hope than in expectation, because ultimately I see the Labour Party as potentially the only force which is big enough to take on things like the City of London. Now, that may sound as if I'm being rather, hopeful there, but I mean, ultimately, the other side see the Labour Party as the potential threat. That's why they parachute people like Tony Blair in on us, to make sure that we behave ourselves. But I mean, that's the struggle. And if you think back to how people used to struggle against the communist system in Eastern Europe, in Poland, for example, which I know a lot about because I used to live over there, a lot of people would join the Communist Party, even though it was not democratic, as a means of trying to leverage change. And I would say I'm a member of the Labour Party now in that same sort of spirit.
I mean, aren't there quite a lot of people that join political parties just to get a piece of the pie? I mean, maybe to get a nice job. Maybe to get a nice job after they finish being an MP or a councillor.
Some do. It's true. But I actually think, but for me, what I get out of the local election campaigns, and I've done quite a lot of campaigning in Bristol, is going and knocking on the doors and talking to ordinary folk. And the Labour vote, Labour people are very loyal. Daniela said when she was on here, was a green candidate for mayor. She said,
she's now a
councillor for Bishopstone. She said, when I knock on a door and somebody is going to vote Labour, they don't say, I'm going to vote Labour. They say, I am Labour. My dad was Labour. My granddad was Labour. And there's a loyalty there which was cruelly misused sometimes. I think Tony Blair cruelly misused it, but people are also very, very understanding. They realise what a dirty game it is, but they're still loyal to Labour because Labour does represent... all that's decent.
It's fair to say there's been a bit of blowback within the Labour Party after Blair, anyway. Okay, I'm just looking at the membership of some of these political parties. In 2012, we have... I'm going to put this question to both of you. I had a discussion with Peter Abrahams, from the leader of the Tory group, last week about the different numbers of people who have partaken in trade unions and in political parties. I'd like you both to have a guess how many times more people are members of trade unions in Britain than are of... any of the main four political parties. Martin, would you like to have a hazard a guess?
It must be at least 5 to 10 times more.
Dave?
I've got to say, I mean, I was quite shocked at how few actual members that some of the big political parties seem to have on Facebook and stuff like that, you know. So, and I can imagine workers kind of unions having a lot more, because
let's have your guess. Come on, okay, this is a quiz.
Three times.
There are 15 times more members of trade unions in Britain than of political parties. Now, in 2012, UK trade unions had roughly 8 million people as actual members, and UK political parties about 500,000, 480,000.
Can I just make a point of order here, which is that every individual member of a trade union has a right to vote in internal Labour Party elections, and it was the trade union
that only voted. Ones that are affiliated to the Labour Party. Only ones quite a few
that's
have true, decided
that's
to
true.
Step
some,
back.
Some are not affiliated. Of those that are affiliated to the Labour Party, and it was in fact the individual votes of individual trade union members which gave Ed Miliband the leadership of the Labour Party, as opposed to his brother, much to the disgust of the City of London and the right wing of the Labour Party.
So I mean, there's 15 times more democratic right in a trade unionist than there is in a politician, which is a bizarre, since the politicians are actually controlling things, if the banks aren't, the politicians are. But anyway, look, just looking at the Labour Party on its own, Martin, I mean, back in at its peak in 1957, there were 1 million members of the Labour Party. Now we're right down, not sure of the actual numbers nowadays, but we're now down to about a quarter of the level of 1980. So there's been a massive fall.
What's the number? What's the actual figure?
For now, I don't know. I'm sorry. Oh, but I know is 1 million were members of the Labour Party in 1957. 1957 was the biggest peak of any political party in this country. It was 1 million people. So, obviously, there were things going on in the 50s that people felt, wow, politics is working. It's doing something. And they were willing to join parties. But we're now down to the levels of a quarter of 1980. I'd just like to ask you, Martin, why did you put that down to? From 1980, people three quarters of everyone that was a member of the political party has given up and gone home.
Well, it's not just the Labour Party, it's all parties. Don't forget, in 1957, the Second World War was a memory, a very, very close memory. So it was literally a decade before. And, of course, people also remember that the National Health Service had been brought in during that decade. So people had very good reasons for seeing the Labour Party as a very useful thing to belong to. And don't forget, people had a different kind of social life in those days. I mean, the Conservative Party, for many years, was basically a massive marriage bureau. You know, people joined the Conservative Party to meet people of their own social level, you know, solicitors and teachers and what have you, and find marriage partners. And they used to, I mean, political parties used to run, they used to have clubs where people used to go, and there was all sorts of things that people used. What's happened is loads of things have happened since then, which give people other things to think about, other things to do. They go shopping.
Okay, I've just got the figures, Dave, before you come in there. The Labour Party is around about 190,000 currently. Actually, this is the figures for 2010. The Conservative Party, 140,000. The Lib Dems, 50,000 now. So they've come down, I mean, you know, one-fifth of their peak now, Labour, for example. Right, Dave?
Well, I can say, well, you made a very interesting point about clubs, because I wouldn't consider myself a politician at all, and I've never really run to win. But the first time I got involved in politics was in Brighton. And I used to go to all the protests, and I still do go to all the protests, I guess, and every time there's some kind of protest going on, and if it's for a worthy cause, I'll invariably go along, because I think if you don't actually protest and directly get involved. Anyway, staying with that particular thread, we had a sound system in Brighton called Bob Dobbs. It was just a Bob system. We called it the Bob, but we used to put on these Bob parties, and we dragged the sound system all over the place. And suddenly the Criminal Justice Bill just came in, and it made gathering illegal. And when gathering became illegal, and we were running sort of like these illegal parties, we suddenly realized that if we registered a political party, we had the right to gather, and we had the right for our own 24-hour members-only bar. And so that's why we ran in the first place, just so we could actually have legal parties, because it gave us back everything the Criminal Justice Bill attempted to take away. And our first meeting we had at the Concord, we had Norman Cook come and play. Mm-hmm. And he came and played at our all-night meeting, and it suddenly it just brought life.